across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Thank you for returning to my show. Thank you very much for the response to our haunting show, direct in stereo from Hampton Court Palace. Very exciting to go there. I love that place. And even though I don't live too far from it, you know, I don't get to go there as often as I should. And if you're ever in London, you have to visit Hampton Court Palace. It is about a half-hour train ride from the centre of London. So if you're staying in London and visiting sightseeing here, make that trip. You won't regret it. And they claim it is the most haunted place in Britain. And I have no doubt that it probably is. There are so many stories about it. And even that famous YouTube video that circulated a few years ago. And a lot of people claimed, nah, it was a fake. Looks pretty credible to me, but you decide. And thank you to Rupert Matthews, the author of Haunted Surrey. And I found him a great guy, really good to talk to. And let's hope that that book that he's got out does really well. But, you know, a man with a lot of knowledge about ghosts. Always interesting to hear. Now, this time round, the guest is a special one. His name is Gerard Artson. And he's a man who I find it very hard to describe because he's not exactly a UFO and alien man. He's not exactly an extraterrestrial or interdimensional personality man. And he's not exactly a man who comments on current affairs and what's going on this planet. But he's all of those things together, I think. So after trying for a while and one or two false starts along the way, mostly to do with my schedule during this summer, we've been able to connect with Gerard Artson in Amsterdam. I'm going to cross to him very soon. Now, I've been trying to get the best possible digital connection to him. There are a couple of problems on this digital line. Nothing very serious, and if you used to listen to shortwave radio in the old days, you'll know what fading and interference is like. This is nothing like that, but there are occasional digital glitches on this line. But I think he's worth hearing, and I can hear every word, so I hope you can bear with it and hear it. Now, if you're still having problems using Windows 7 and iTunes to get these shows, let me and let them know about this. But I think the problems have been resolved now, which is good news. I know that one or two of the shows, like the 9/11 special, a couple of the recent ones, some of you using Windows 7 and iTunes had problems getting hold of. So the answer in the first instance to that problem really is, if you want to find out what's new on the show, come first to the website, www.theunexplained.tv, www.theunexplained.tv, designed by Adam Cornwell, of course, as ever, at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. That is your one-stop shop for everything to do with this show. If you'd like to make a donation there, gratefully received, to keep this work going, and also to provide, I don't know, a platform for the future for this show. I want to develop it. I want it to be much bigger. I'm not a great believer in the mainstream media doing shows like this, because if they do, they don't do them right, and they trivialize them. I think you have to have a certain love for and knowledge of the subjects to do shows like this, and so I don't think the mainstream media is ever really going to do it there. And I say that as somebody who does some news work in mainstream media, being a journalist and on air. It's hard for me to say that, but it's just the truth. You look at things the way they are now, and you know that the mainstream media is not really going to do this kind of thing. And I think that's increasingly going to be the case, that to get the information that you need in this fast-changing world where events are shocking and move at an incredible pace, I don't think you're going to get it anymore from the mainstream media. I think we have to make our own arrangements, as they say. If you support that idea, if you want to give me some thoughts on the show, please email me through the website, www.theunexplained.tv. Right, hopefully this digital line's going to hold up. Let's cross now to Amsterdam in the Netherlands and talk with Gerard Artson. Gerard, thank you very much for coming on The Unexplained.
Thank you very much.
And a pleasure for me to connect to Amsterdam. I don't think in my career, actually, I've interviewed anybody in Amsterdam before. So it's a first on all kinds of levels, Gerard.
And it's a privilege for me.
Well, listen, I've got you on here, and I have to say to my shame, not because I'd heard of what you do, but because a couple of my listeners said, you've really got to talk to this guy. And once again, it's one of those cases where I went online and I started researching you, and then I thought, I've really got to talk to this guy. And then I saw the number of appearances that you make and speeches that you give and books that you've written, and there was another reason for talking to you. So nice to have you on. How would you describe yourself?
Oops. Well, actually, I think for the work that I do and that you're interviewing me about, I would describe myself as a student of the ageless wisdom teaching. But in daily life, you know, I have a job as a teacher educator, in fact. But my research and my study into the ageless wisdom teachings have led me to try and build a catalog of titles that I find worthwhile, and it introduced me to the teachings of George Adamski that many people knew about in 1950s and 60s because he was world famous, very many of the younger generations have hardly even heard of him just because he's been so debunked and ridiculed and defamed. For many people, when I go and speak somewhere now, I visited some conferences and I've been interviewed many times, as you said, many of the younger people don't seem to have heard of him anymore.
Well, the name of Adamski, I've heard and I've seen online, but that's all I know. So explain to me why I should be aware of Adamski's work.
George Adamski was the first person to write about his experiences. First of all, he was one of the first to publish photographs of flying saucers and motherships that he made through his telescope and with his camera directly without the telescope connected. His meetings with people from space, which caused, as you can imagine, a major stir in the 1950s. His report of his first meeting in the desert, California desert, in November 1952 was included in Desmond Leslie's book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, and for that very reason became an overnight sensation. And it was reprinted in America in the first 12 times in the first 3 years.
So if this man's work has been, I won't say forgotten, but isn't being talked about as much as perhaps you think it should, and yet it's as mind-blowing as that, how come we're in that situation where you're having to remind people about him?
That is because when the authorities and the powers that be, the military, I suppose, saw how much interest there was in Adamski's story. We're talking about 1952. In 1953, he had additional experiences. He was taken aboard a saucer, brought to a mothership, visited other planets, and his popularity, the interest in his information was such that within a few years, his book, which was his second book, which was published in 1955, was translated into several languages. The first book, with which he co-wrote with Desmond Leslie, was translated in almost in 8 or 9 languages for a non-fiction book, mind you. It's unheard of. It's very interesting because most people tend to forget this when they talk about abductions and everything. The interesting thing is that along with Adamski and there were many other of the early contactees who spoke very highly of the space people that they met, never spoke of having been abducted. The abduction stories, if you go back in history, in the UFO lore and stories and everything, only began to emerge after Adamski had begun to be defamed and ridiculed.
That's true. I mean, that's Betty and Barney Hill and all the others. So do you think he was just ahead of his time?
I can't say he was ahead of his time. He was perhaps fortunate enough, or maybe not, depending on how you look at it, to be the first of all these people who had contacted, who had been contacted by people from space. And because it caused such a massive interest around the world, the authorities saw fit to ridicule him and his information to the extent that it came down to character assassination and to the point where most serious UFO researchers now don't even refer to Adamski anymore for fear of being ridiculed themselves.
So you think that what you need to do out there and what you're doing out there is refining this work or just simply reintroducing this work?
What I've done is I've looked at the his writings that are still surprisingly easily available, easily accessible. His books are, have been reprinted many times, as I said, and they're easily available in secondhand bookshops, online, etc. But there's quite a few publications that were sent out only to people who had subscribed to them. So there's small bulletins and other newsletters, some courses, self-study courses, that hardly anyone ever even knew about before I had uncovered them again and wrote about in my book. And the interesting thing is that in these publications, in these bulletins, Adamski writes about teachings which he receives from the space people, his space contacts, that are very, they chime in very closely with the teachings that we have received through, the men of wisdom throughout the ages. And interestingly, and this is how I came to investigate and research Adamski's claims. His very first book, 1936, not many people have heard of it, but it's been in print almost all this time since 1936. His very first book was called Wisdom of the Masters of the Far East. You may have heard of Bertie Spalding's book, Life and Teaching of the Masters mm-hmm. of the Far East. Mm-hmm. Has been very popular. But Adamski had his own book, and through research and connecting dots that have previously been left unconnected, did I find that Adamski, as a teenager, was sent to Tibet. Study there with the Masters of Wisdom prepared for his later mission to tell the world, to expand our horizon, tell the world about the fact that life is everywhere and every planet is inhabited.
All right. Well, how does that happen, though? I mean, when I was a teenager, nobody said to me, Howard, we think that you have a mission here. Whether I had a mission or not, we're going to send you to Tibet. How did that happen to this guy?
He was his family emigrated from Poland, what is now Poland, to the United States when George was only 2 years old. And on the way there, at the time, it was too expensive to fly. No, I don't think they didn't even have airplanes then yet. This was late 19th century. George Adamski. 1891. Yeah, so that would have been 1893 or 4. So they went by ocean liner, and during the voyage, they were befriended by a stranger, a tall, dark stranger. And it so happened that after they had settled in Dunkirk, New York, George, when he was going to school from the age of 4 or something, kept running into this same man, and he became a friend of the family. He called him Uncle Sid. And when George's father had died at a very young age, this Uncle Sid sort of took over paternal responsibilities for the family. And apparently, Uncle Sid had connections with these people in Tibet, and suggested to his mother that that he would send him, and he would finance it. He would provide the money for George to be trained in Tibet, and that's how it's happened, according to the sources that I found about that.
Well, that is a fascinating story. What was he trained in?
Yes, I suppose you could say, trained in the Eastern philosophy of life, meditation, the control over his lower nature and some laws of physics. Apparently, he had some abilities that you would normally find among yogis, the yogis of India. But he always asked his close associates not to to speak about it, except that in one of my sources, a very interesting book by his Swiss contact, main contact in the 1950s and 60s, Lou Zinstag. She writes about an occasion where on a visit to Rome, George diagnosed the cause of the deformation of an eye of a little boy in Rome. He could focus his eyesight in such a way that it almost functioned like an X-ray, and he could pinpoint exactly where a tumor was or something.
So was he a psychic healer?
No, because he didn't heal. He could just see, and I don't know if he couldn't heal or not. But
so what he was a sensitive, by the sounds of it, somebody who was sensitive to vibrations, to things.
Yes, and maybe he had etheric vision. The information doesn't go that far, but in any case, many people have heard of what's his name again? Paramahansa Yogananda's autobiography of a yogi, in which Yogananda describes many supernatural powers that people can actually train themselves in, even though they're not very highly evolved. But when you train with the masters of wisdom, who are the group of people who have gone beyond the human stage in evolution, then of course the door is open to all kinds of things that normal people would not learn in school.
I have to say, just at this point, we're having some problems with the connection to you, but I want to persevere with it because the interference on the line there only comes every couple of minutes or so, and it's very, very slight. But if you're hearing some slight distortion that appears every 2 minutes or so, that's what it is, and that's just down to the nature of doing these digital connections. And I want to keep this conversation going because it's fascinating. You clearly believe all of this is true, but how are we, as people who are observing this and listening to you telling these stories, how are we to know that it's true?
Well, see, I can't convince anyone. I don't want to convince anyone. But what I can do is point out the sources for much of the same claims and many of the same teachings. If you go back in history, in this case, if we go back to the founding of the Theosophical Society by Madame Blavatsky in the late 19th century, and go to her and look at her work, the Isis Unveiled, the Secret Doctrine, and the teachings that have come after her as an elaboration through Alice Ann Bailey, more recently through Benjamin Graham, you will see that those teachings, which can also be found at the heart of all the major religions and schools of philosophy throughout the ages, which are based on harmlessness, right human relations, then it is very interesting, if not to say compelling, to see that that is exactly the same kind of teaching that Adamski received through his contacts from space.
So there's a common thread.
I would say, even more than a common thread. There's a common source, apparently, that Adamski's contacts from space were reminding us of from their point of view. From the planets where they came from, according to Adamski. His contacts came mainly from Venus and some from Saturn and Mars.
All right, well, let's just pause it there because we've got to take stock of where we've come from and where we're going to here. Here we have this remarkable young man who makes a great voyage with his family, meets a stranger who becomes instrumental in his life. That stranger introduces him to some very wise people in Tibet. They teach him some ancient ways. This then equips him to do other things and to be able to make these contacts through which he gets that knowledge. Yep.
I don't think that he was trained for the contacts as such. I think he was trained more, to validate the contacts.
Well, they opened his mind by the sound of it.
Life. Mm. But it definitely trained him to deal with, you know, everything that that came about as a result of these contacts and his writing and speaking about it.
So when he'd had that preparation, what did he do and where did he go?
Actually, after his preparation in Tibet, he went back to America. He joined the army. He served at the Mexican border, in the Mexican War on the U.S. border with Mexico. From what we know, in the 1920s and 30s, he even describes himself as a wandering teacher around California. That is. And he had a group of followers who were really interested in what he had to say and teach. He founded the temple of some kind of temple as a center for his teachings. And many of his talks were broadcast on local radio stations in those days. And in 1936, he published a summary of these teachings as the wisdom of the masters of the Far East.
I would have thought that in 1936, even with the broadcasts, with those sorts of teachings and with those sorts of prognostications, whatever you might call it, that he was making, people would have seen him as mad.
Apparently not everyone. And you must remember, this is also the time when Spalding's books about the masters, his experiences with the masters, came out in the same the same state, California, apparently, they went on to become world famous as well. So there was a great deal of interest in that topic already, we've also come out of this whole new thought movement that arose at the end of the 19th century. With many of the yogis of that time, Indian yogis visiting the United States with Swamis, Swami Vivekananda. So there was a lot of interest in metaphysical things.
Okay, and tell me about his contact, maybe the first one.
From his first book, the publication of his first book, to his first sighting, which Adamski says was in 1946, but we have reasons to believe that that he actually saw flying saucers well before that, and perhaps even had contacts well before that. Maybe he wasn't allowed to speak about them. But in 1946, he published a flyer, a brochure called, what was it called again? The Possibility of Life on Other Planets. And in
great
1949,
title.
Yes. And in 1949, he published a book that he listed as fiction, and it's called Pioneers of Space. But the interesting thing is that many of the descriptions in that book reoccur in his second book, in his second book on non-fiction book on flying saucers, Inside the Spaceships, which was his personal report of contacts and trips on flying saucers and motherships.
And all of this dovetails with the time of Roswell. That was 1947, and he was there doing all of that at the same time as Roswell was happening. Is that just coincidence or not?
Far from it. I mean, the space people have been trying to help the governments of the world and to help humanity at large to see and understand and accept the fact that Earth is not a chemical accident in the universe, but rather, you know, one of a family of planets in this solar system, in any case, that are all inhabited. There's a huge plan of evolution for cosmos, and that plan is sort of reproduced, you could say, for every solar system.
So if they want us to know that, why don't they come here and tell us themselves? I mean, not just one person, one special being, why not tell everybody?
Well, it wasn't just Adamski, of course. There have been many people who have been contacted, but they are very, very careful. They know that for many centuries, humanity as a species has been quite ignorant. We've come from the Middle Ages through the Enlightenment and all the scientific and technological developments. But apparently somewhere along the way we lost that sense of spirituality, the source of our being, and therefore we don't realize that even though life does not occur in physical form, dense physical form on other planets, doesn't mean that there's no life possible there. Our science recognizes obviously the solid physical, the liquid physical, and the gaseous physical. But according to the Ageless Wisdom teachings, there are four higher levels of matter, the etheric physical planes, and that is where life on the other planets takes place. And apparently, if you go to Mars, you would see that it's teeming with life there, you know, plants and animals and people. If you were able to do that with etheric vision. You know, we don't have etheric vision at the moment. Not many of us. Some people do, and they are able to see people's auras.
How can you get it?
I think it's a matter of evolutionary progress.
Meaning?
Becoming less attached to the physical form. And we see it happen in you know, more and more children being born now with etheric vision. They can see auras, or they do see the elves or the natural beings. We are able by now to record auras or energy fields around living tissue on Killian photographs. Yeah, for a long time that wasn't possible, but that's possible now.
That's a technology, if you can call Killian photographs a technology, that goes back a long time, century or more, doesn't it?
I don't think it was a century, because photography is just about a century and a half old. I think Semyon Killian invented it. I don't know by heart, but sometime in the 20th century.
Okay, now you talked about Mars being teeming with life, and there are people who suspect that, and they have different perspectives to come at this from. People like Richard C. Hoagland, for example, who we have on this show from time to time, who comes at this from a different perspective. What do you think, Gerard, about the fact that we seem to be discovering more about Mars, like, for example, frozen water, as it appears to be, that kind of thing, but more discoveries all the time about Mars? Is that because we're getting cleverer? Is it because we're getting traces of this etheric vision? Or is it because somebody there wants us to know more and more?
Well, I suppose it comes from many different sources. For one, our technology becomes better, and there's also more and more leaks, if you will, from the space agencies, who have irrefutable proof of flying saucer spacecraft that are not from Earth.
Now, that's a great statement to make, and I've heard many people make it. Can you give me some proof or something that you've been told that would back that up?
I've seen several clips on YouTube that...
But we've all seen those.
Well, you know, if you don't consider that proof, then no. I can't help you. But there's more and more astronauts who will testify to the fact that they've either seen the spaceships that are not from Earth, or have even in some cases had communication with them. If you listen, more and more astronauts are coming out now, Edgar Mitchell being one of them, but I know there have been others. Pilots, there's many people from the military in the United States. There was a press conference in September last year, organized by what's his name again? Robert Hastings, where he had seven people from a group of 120 who have gone on the record to state that they have seen UFOs over nuclear facilities in the United States or elsewhere. So if that doesn't count as proof, you know, what will? Going back to your question about why don't the UFOs or the space people show themselves to the whole of the world, to everyone. They have this, first of all, you have the universal law of non-interference. And they know they need to be careful in order not to send shockwaves across the world, especially since having been given the physical proof, the crash in Roswell was, according to Benjamin Graham, was a deliberate sacrifice, and there have been several other crashes, so that our scientists and our governments would have physical proof of their presence and their existence.
Now, I read something about you on your website, or on a website. I believe it was your website I saw this quote, and I wonder if I can just read it to you and tell me what it means. With the return of our elder brothers, the Masters, headed by the World Teacher, and the coming of the Space Brothers now, at the dawn of the new age of Aquarius, humanity will be able and willing to create a new civilization through sharing and cooperation based on a realization of our essential oneness. I think I know what that means, but I think you probably tell me better than I could explain it.
Well, yes. See, the most people think of the coming of the presence of the UFOs and the space people as some kind of event in itself. It isn't. They are here in support of a major transition that we're going through. It's a historical period of in the history of mankind when we will be reintroduced to the fact of the existence of a kingdom in nature above the human kingdom. I mentioned it a bit earlier. There are people who have gone ahead of us in evolution, the Masters of Wisdom. They have completed the path of evolution on this planet. 98,000 years ago, they withdrew from everyday life into remote mountain and desert areas, which was at the time of the destruction of Atlantis, and left humanity to its own devices to come to its own realization of what's worthwhile in life and what is real and what's not real. And we have now come to a point as a group, as a species in our evolution, where the Masters see fit to return, to make themselves known again. And this was begun, the first information about the existence of the Masters was given out through the work of Madame Blavatsky in the late 19th century, and then elaborated on by Alice Ann Bailey and Benjamin Graham. And the last name, Benjamin Graham, he says that since 1975, since 1977, the first group of Masters has returned into the world. And what we are now witnessing, when you look around the world, you know, it's staggering to see the level of incompetence at among political leaders, economic leaders, financial leaders, military leaders. It's very interesting to see how little confidence people have in their leadership.
Well, I have to say, I mean, here on this earth that we can see and feel and touch, a lot of people are starting to feel that way. I have to be honest, and I can say it here on this forum, I'm starting to feel that way. I look at the quality of decision making, you look at the financial trouble we've got ourselves into in this planet, and you start to either see conspiracy theories or you just see, as you've said, sheer incompetence. And, you know, if there was anybody on another dimension, if we did have Masters up there helping us, I think we need them now.
Well, they are here now, and they're waiting for the best moment to show themselves. But what they have been doing all along is to feed and inspire the movement that we can see now. At the moment, it's Occupy Wall Street that's getting a lot of attention on the internet, not so much in the mainstream media, but and it was inspired, the occupation of Wall Street, and it's been spreading across the United States. It was inspired by what happened in Egypt and Morocco at the beginning of this year, and it's still going on in some other Arab countries.
All right, so the message that you're here to give then is very, very contemporary. I mean, it's about as contemporary, it's about as up-to-date as you can get. All of this stuff that you're telling us about connects into everything that's happening right now.
Absolutely, yes. It went on in Greece and Spain, and now it's in the US. People are waking up. they are waking up to the realization that they are the ones to make the change that is necessary. They are the ones to call up the leaders and take responsibility or move out of the way.
Well, it would be nice to think that would happen. And I heard a theory. I think it was a guy. There's a guy on RT, you know, that Russian television channel called Kaiser. And I've become a big fan of this guy because last night he was espousing the theory of how the financial crash that we've had has been kind of a result of partly incompetence, like you say, and partly the actions of bankers who have short-sold bad investments. And it's happened a number of times in our history, but we're heading for something now that is catastrophic. So all of these themes seem in their own diverse and very strange and possibly nebulous ways, but they tie together.
They do, and it's to do with the fact that we're moving from the old age, the age of Pisces, to a new age, the age of Aquarius. That is not a fantasy that was made up by the hippies in the 1960s. This is an astronomical fact. If you look at the solar system, and anyone who bothers to go to an observatory, they can establish that fact for themselves. The solar system has been moving out of the influence, so to speak, an alignment with the constellation of Pisces into a similar alignment with influence with the constellation of Aquarius.
But most people have been aware of that, you know, ever since the song from the musical, you know, the Age of Aquarius. Most people have been aware of that, but we're still waiting to see the practical effects of it.
Yes, and these things won't become visible overnight. I mean, we're talking about cosmic ages that go on for 2,150 years. They build up. The energies coming from those constellations make our response to those energies, make our lives, our societies, our culture, our institutions to what they are now. The institutions that we are still living with now and that are breaking down in front of our eyes are built on our response to the old energies, and they're based on our misinterpretation in many ways, you know, based on greed and competition.
So the message that you have for now, and I think it's very important that we refine this, the message that you have for now, and I'm sorry to interrupt, is very much one for now. It's almost like a wake-up call, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. And I'm just one of many voices. I bring it together from perhaps a slightly different point of view, but it all comes down to the same thing. Humanity is awakening to the fact of their spiritual source, their spiritual realities of life. We are not, as I said, you know, life on this planet, as many scientists still believe, the result of a chemical accident in one part of a remote part of the universe.
So if we're not the result of a chemical accident, who made us? Big question, eh?
Yeah. And, well, the answer is bigger than the words that I could find for it. But there is, I mean, some people call it God, others call it the Absolute. In the teachings, it's called the Logos of the planet, who serves the Logos of, you know, the solar system. And in turn, the solar Logos serves the plan of the galactic Logos. There's no end to it. There's an endless connection between the tiniest molecule or atom and the largest set of galaxies that you could imagine.
Now, Gerard, there's a problem with this, and you make a very coherent case, and I find it, despite the slight digital distortion we've got on this connection, I've wanted to keep this conversation going because I'm really interested in it. There is a problem, and the problem is this. If you look on the internet, there are all sorts of weird and strange to me looking, and, you know, I'm into these things and they look strange to me, groups and cults and sects and people like that who are saying kind of similar things. And I just wonder sometimes how we're to know who is genuine in the pursuit of all of this and who really is just wacko. It's difficult because there are so many interpretations of the stuff that you're saying out there now.
Yes, you're absolutely right. There are. And as always, there are people who, and the same actually goes for stories of contact with the people from space. There are people who have such a vivid imagination that they actually believe that they receive channeled messages or whatever. The good news is that we can just, well, I would not suggest that we wait, but instead be active and contribute to changes that we think are necessary. But as we do that, through the events that are unfolding now, you will see that soon enough, the world teacher that you mentioned from the quote on my website is stepping forward. He's currently involved in a series of TV interviews in the United States. Has already...
We do have to do a bit of explaining here. Who is the world teacher? This person is doing interviews. What's this all about?
The world teacher, you mentioned him in the quote that you took from my website.
Yes, that's right.
He is the master of all the masters. He is the...
So this is an actual... I missed this point. Thank you for refining it for me. This is an actual person now.
He is, absolutely.
Sounds like a messiah to me. Is this a messiah you're saying?
Well, you know, Christians expect the second coming of the Christ. The Jews are still waiting for the Messiah.
And you're telling me we have Muslims, that now. We've got that
the
now.
The Muslims, just to complete the picture, if you don't mind,
sure.
The Muslims are waiting for the Imam Mahdi, the great Mahdi. The Buddhists are waiting for the fifth Buddha. And according to Benjamin Krem, these are all names, different names for the same individual, for the world teacher. And his own name, his personal name, is Maitreya. The Buddhists had that part right. And since we are now at the beginning of a new cosmic cycle, since we are now at such a crucial point in our history where things could go terribly wrong, if we make the wrong choices, if we choose to go ahead on the path of greed and competition, then more chaos and more conflict will result in a nuclear war that will destroy all life on this planet. So the world teacher, along with a large group of the masters of wisdom, have decided to come to return at the earliest possible moment.
So this is a person that is doing television interviews in America right now.
Yeah, incognito for now, because he wants people to respond to his message from their heart, not because somebody else tells him he is the world teacher or he is the one that you're expecting as the Christ or the Buddha.
So how are we to differentiate this person from a number I've seen of people who I think are somewhat dubious alleged gurus out there on the internet? How are we going to tell, if you tell me this person is genuine and has a genuine message, and I don't want to sound too skeptical, but I have to say this because my listeners will ask this, and I want to know, how can we tell this person from some of those people who I have real doubts about when I look on the internet?
There will come a day, and according to Benjamin Krem, whose information this is based on, there will come a day very soon, within a few years, when this person will come on television, when all the television networks are linked together by satellite, and he will be invited to speak to the world. And while we hear his words, you will, as a native English speaker, you will hear him in English. As a native Dutch speaker, I will hear him in Dutch, because his thoughts will be transferred directly to everyone's brain, which will translate his telepathic message, because he will be mentally overshadowing all of humanity at the same time around the world. So you will.
And he is here now. I'm sorry to ask you that again, but it's just so mind-blowing.
He's been in the world since 1977, gradually preparing for this immense event.
Have you spoken to him?
No, not as such.
Would you like to?
Obviously, yes.
Have you been in contact in any way with him?
No. He does appear in various guises to people, you know, in support or in succor, sometimes to rescue people, along with some of the other masters. And in one or two of those guises, I've experienced him. But, you know, that is not in the same way that I'm describing now, when he will appear before the world, when he will mentally overshadow the whole world when hundreds of thousands of spontaneous healings will take place. And
sounds to me like, if you look at the world as we have it now, Gerard, and you know, I don't want to diss any of this because I, like I said, I find it really interesting, but a big leap of mind is going to have to happen to get the vast majority of ordinary people. I mean, for a start off, the people who run the media, you say that the people who run the media on this planet now are going to invite this person to go on air. I know some of these people. I think that's highly unlikely as things stand right now.
Yes. Well, have you seen the popular movement that's rising up now? If that's anything to go by, within a few years, because of the economic problems that we're in and that are getting worse, and because of the lack of answers from the leaders, because they don't know where to look for solutions anymore, this will lead to the pressure on the governments and the media to invite this person, this world teacher, forward. It's all building to that moment, and that day, which has been called the Day of Declaration, when he will already be known around the world because of his interviews.
Are you telling me that world leaders, Obama, David Cameron in the UK, whoever else, already know of this person's existence?
I don't think many of them will know of his existence. They may have heard vaguely about it, but I do know that many people in the media have met this person, have met
really?
Maitreya.
Well, I'd love to.
and many with you, but he organized a conference in 1990, I believe, in London, where he invited many of the world leaders at the time, and also many of the leaders and journalists from the media. So it's all building up to that Day of Declaration.
Now, here's my difficulty with some of this. And like I say, I'm very, very open-minded. Hell, that's why I'm doing this. However, the journalist in me says, this would be great. And if ever we needed some kind of savior, my God, we need one now. And we're going to in the future, if what I sense is going to happen to all of us in the future does happen or anything like it. However, what I would ask, were there to be a news conference with this person, is for this person to demonstrate to me some ability that I couldn't do, something that I couldn't do, like walk through a wall or levitate. I know it's a party trick. I know it's a magic stunt, but I want to see something like that, and then I will believe. Until then, my jury's out.
Of course. How about mentally overshadowing 6.7 billion people at the same time, who will all testify afterwards to the fact that they've heard exactly the same message, except everyone in their own language, and hundreds of thousands of spontaneous healings, and people almost feeling physically embraced by the energy of love that will be a divine love, that is, that will stream out from him.
I can hear thousands of people listening to this right now shouting, bring it on. You know, why wait?
Yes,
let's do it.
It's going. Yes, they'll have to be patient for a little while longer, but that is exactly what everyone will be experiencing. So everyone can just vouchsafe for themselves that this was an authentic, or this is the person that Benjamin Graham has been announcing, that has been announced since the work of Madame Blavatsky. This is the world teacher. Nobody else would be able to do that. This is the person who embodies on this planet the energy of love. There's only one person who can do that, and that is the world teacher. And then, of course, after that, he will introduce some of the masters. Among the first group will be the Master Jesus.
You're telling me, and this is very serious, so, you know, I'm not being flippant at all about this. You're saying that Jesus is coming back.
Jesus has been back since, I believe, 1980.
And what do you say to people who say that that is an incredible blasphemy?
Well, probably, you know, I would say they've misinterpreted the being, the nature of the being who is Jesus, or they don't understand.
Well, I know that really, as a kid in school, we were taught that Jesus would one day return. You know, we were taught in school when I was small that Jesus would come back, but I don't think that the people who taught me scriptures when I was at school as an academic study when I was a kid, anticipated it might be like this?
No. And that is, unfortunately, the responsibility of the churches, and especially the early church fathers, who have completely misinterpreted for their own purposes, the real nature of Jesus and the Christ, and have misinformed their flock, so to speak, for reasons of self-interest and worldly power.
Do you worry about what you're saying? Because some of this is dynamite. To people who have their faith and their beliefs, some of this is not going to go down too well.
Well, I'm happy to leave it to the masses. Once they're openly known, I mean, the many fundamentalist Christians or fundamentalists from any religion will have difficulty coming to grips with the new reality that they will have been presented with. But, leave it to the masses. I don't need to convince anyone. So I'm happy to leave it with the masses. And if people don't believe it in this lifetime, if they're too crystallized in their thinking, they will die and they will reincarnate in a world where the masters and the world teacher are known, are central to everybody's life.
So you're saying that it's coming to us all, whether we want to accept it or not, we're going to get it.
We're going to get it, yes, because it's that time in our history, in our evolution, where the great center on this planet, which is humanity, is going to be reconnected with the great center that is the spiritual hierarchy of masters.
Is this happening in your lifetime?
This is happening in our lifetime, yes. Mm-hmm. If I'm not going to get run over by a bus tomorrow...
I hope not.
I hope not, but this is going to happen within a few years.
And what happens if you get... I know you're... Well, you may not want me to say how old you are, but you're whatever age you are. Say 20 years pass and you're an older man than you are now. What happens if none of this has happened? Will you be disillusioned or will you keep believing? Will you change what you believe to suit the timeline?
Well, see, the interesting thing is, for me, it's not a belief because I'm 53, by the way, and I first heard...
I didn't want to say it before you did, okay?
I don't think I'm at all concerned about my age. But to answer your question, it's interesting to mention the fact that I'm 53 now, because when I first heard about this story, about this information, which is really the revelatory phase of the teachings of wisdom that have been presented since the late 19th century, I was about 20 years old, and it was presented at the time as something that could happen at the earliest possible moment in the spring of 1982. It didn't happen then because the media were, as you've indicated already, uncooperative. There was a major news press conference done by Benjamin Graham in Los Angeles, and he was asking the media, the world's media, to go to London, send some of their senior journalists, and Maitreya would present himself to them.
Well, of course, in 1982, from what I remember, and I was a little younger then, as we both were, the UK had a bit of a problem. We were at war with Argentina over the Falkland Islands at that time, so we had something else making headlines.
Yeah, that was one thing. And since then, various things have happened that have brought the emergence of the masters and the world teacher ever closer. But as I said, for me, it's not a belief because, interestingly, when I was 19 years old, I'd been to India once overland as a backpacker. Not at all for looking for spiritual enlightenment or to join a guru or anything like that. Instead, I was very politically oriented, and I was looking for solutions to the world's problems along any of the political lines, and many of which I investigated then. And I was, I was involved with Amnesty International. I was, rather more activist. One morning in August 1978, I woke up with an overwhelming sense of joy and without any memory of a dream or a vision, and one realization, the Christ is back. And you must remember that I was not at all interested in religion. I had stopped going to church. I was brought up a Roman Catholic. I'd stopped going to church at age 14, and not interested in religion. And I, for the life of me, could not imagine why I would be interested in the Christ being back. But that was the only thing I remembered waking up, the Christ, and I was so happy about it. And
at that time, forgive me for this question, but you are talking from Holland, so it's not as bad a question as it might be for somebody in the UK. You weren't experimenting with substances at that time. Forgive me for the question.
No, I wasn't actually. No.
Okay, all right. No. I'm sorry for asking, but you know, no. My listeners will ask me why I didn't ask you that. Okay.
No, that's all right. But that was not it. But about a month later, I read the first interview that Benjamin Krem gave outside the UK. Was published in a Dutch magazine, and that's and he talked about the teachings of Madame Blavatsky and Alice Bailey, etc., Ageless Wisdom teachings, and that's when I realized, oh wait, this is what my realization about the Christ being back is all about.
Now, so for me, going to be saved? And I'm sorry that our time is limited, so I want to bring you to this point, Gerard. And I'm sorry that I seem to keep interrupting. We're facing terrible problems in this world, and I'm not convinced that our politicians have the answer. I'm not convinced that the euro, for example, is out of the woods yet at all. I'm not convinced that the American economy is out of the woods at all. If, and I don't want this to happen for all kinds of reasons, and some of those are personal, if we have some big financial crisis meltdown in a year or whatever, will they come and help us then?
See, the meltdown is happening now as we speak. It's we can see it around us. The stock markets may go up and down a little bit, but the general trend is down. The euro is an artificial construct that is not going to survive. The dollar, you know, there's so many printed dollars with no gold or any other kind of basis for it. It's all a fantasy. The whole economic system at the moment is being upheld by the people behind the scenes without any foundation.
It's all being held up, isn't it, by the elastic of confidence with these fiat currencies and all the rest of it. It's all held up by this thin veneer of people being confident in this illusion, it might be. And once you stop believing the illusion, it collapses.
And that's what's happening now. And what I would like to emphasize is that the masses will be coming back at the time of our greatest need, but they will not solve our problems. We must realize that. They will not come to magic away all the problems that we have. We are responsible for the situation that we have created. They will be here to inspire and guide us, to provide us with alternative ideas. They will advise us, but we still have to make the changes. We will have to change from a world based on greed and competition to a world based on cooperation and sharing. We have to make sure that we give expression to the fact that we are one human family.
And a lot of people, as you rightly said, are saying that. Edgar Mitchell I spoke to in March this year, and he said something very, very similar, if not entirely the same as that. So it's not just you who's saying this. Now, you went to the ExoPolitics conference in Leeds, didn't you, a little while ago here in the UK? Leeds is a fairly realistic kind of town. So how did your message go down there?
I was surprised to see. Well, I don't think it's so much to do with the town being realistic. It's to do with the audience there, and I think most of the audience, people in the audience at the Leeds conference, was not from the city of Leeds, but from all over the UK and indeed from many countries in Europe, and the general line of thinking nowadays seems to be of fear-based speculation in circles of ufologists. And my message is basically fundamentally a message of hope. And I must say that I was very surprised and very, very happy to see so many people come to me after my talk and tell me, oh, thank you so much. It's so important to know that there's a positive side to this whole story about UFOs and people coming from space.
I think you're right about this whole thing with ufologists. A lot of them seem to be a bit scared of something, because a lot of them seem to be coming around to the view that whatever this is out there, in their terms, may be malevolent, may not be nice.
Yes. Yes, and I think it's completely misconstrued. It's completely based on the fact of the early conspiracies having covered up everything that the governments knew and military and had seen and had experienced, has caused such mistrust, not entirely undeserved, but that mistrust and suspicion has come up to a level now that fact-based research has been replaced by fear-based speculation.
You know, all right.
There's hardly any sense of realism in it anymore.
Gerard Artson, if people want to know about your work, where do they find it and you?
They can find my work on my website, www.bgapublications.nl. It's in English, the website. I post links to recent articles there. I give updates on where I'll be interviewed or where I'll be speaking. And I'm working on finalizing my second book, Here to Help, UFOs and the Space Brothers, which I hope to publish December or January. And if they check my website, people will find out immediately when it has been published.
Give me the website again.
www.bgapublications.nl.
Gerard Artson, a pleasure to talk to you. I found it very thought-provoking. It's been not an easy conversation because there's been a lot to take in and a lot to understand. Also because of a little bit of distortion on the digital line, so I hope if you're listening to this, you will forgive me for that. I thought it was worth persevering with this because if you remember when we used to listen to shortwave radio, we used to get distortion about every 2 minutes or so with the signal. Very, very similar here. And in fact, I think that was a darn sight clearer than shortwave radio. And that's why I didn't stop this connection, because I wanted to keep this connection and this conversation going. Gerard Artson in Amsterdam, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be on your show. You're Howard.
Thank you, Gerard, very much indeed. My name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained. You can find my website at www.theunexplained.tv, www.theunexplained.tv. Go there to leave me feedback. Leave me a donation if you'd like. Thank you to Adam Cornwell, by the way, our webmaster at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. Thanks, Adam. Thank you to Martin for the theme tune. And above all, as ever, thank you to you for listening to The Unexplained. Please tell your friends about this show. My name is Howard Hughes. We'll be back soon here at The Unexplained.